expect you to explain your actions and behavior tonight? I'm sure he... Tonight? The king laughed. No, Antonio. I am confessing the secret I've kept from Julian his entire life. Chapter 89 ConspiracyNet.com Breaking News Church Under Attack No, not by Edmund Kirsch, by the Spanish police. Chapel Torre Girona in Barcelona is currently under assault by local authorities. Inside, Robert Langdon and Ambre Vidal are believed to be responsible for the successful launch of Edmund Kirsch's greatly anticipated announcement, which is now only minutes away. The countdown has begun. Chapter 90 Ambre Vidal felt a flood of exhilaration as the antique computer pinged happily after Langdon's second attempt to enter the line of poetry. Password correct. Thank God, she thought as Langdon stood up from the desk and turned to her. Ambre immediately put her arms around him and squeezed him in a heartfelt embrace. Edmund would be so grateful. 2 minutes and 33 seconds, Winston chimed. Ambre let go of Langdon, both of them turning to the LCD screens overhead. The center screen displayed a countdown clock she had last seen in the Guggenheim. Live program begins in 2 minutes, 33 seconds. Current remote attendees, 227,257,914. More than 200 million people? Ambre was stunned. Apparently, while she and Langdon were fleeing across Barcelona, the entire world had taken notice. Edmund's audience has become astronomical. Beside the countdown screen, the live security feeds continued to play, and Ambre noticed a sudden shift in the police activity outside. One by one, the officers who had been pounding on doors and talking on radios stopped what they were doing, pulled out their smartphones, and stared down into them. The patio outside the church gradually became a sea of pale, eager faces illuminated by the glow of their handheld displays. Edmund has stopped the world in its tracks, Ambre thought, feeling an eerie sense of responsibility that people around the globe were preparing to view a presentation that would be streaming out of this very room. I wonder if Julian is watching, she thought, then quickly pushed him from her mind. The program is now cued, Winston said. I believe you'll both be more comfortable watching in Edmund's sitting area at the other end of this lab. Thank you, Winston, Langdon said, ushering Ambre barefoot across the smooth glass floor, past the blue-gray metallic cube, and into Edmund's sitting area. Here an oriental carpet had been spread out on the glass floor, along with a collection of elegant furniture and an exercise bike. As Ambre stepped off the glass onto the soft carpet, she felt her body begin to relax. She climbed onto the couch and pulled her feet up beneath her, looking around for Edmund's television. Where do we watch? Langdon apparently didn't hear, having walked to the corner of the room to look at something. But Ambre got her answer an instant later when the entire rear wall of the chamber began glowing from within. A familiar image appeared, projected out from inside the glass. Live program begins in 1 minute, 39 seconds. Current remote attendees, 227,501,173. The entire wall is a display? Ambre stared at the 8-foot-tall image as the lights in the church slowly dimmed. Winston, it seemed, was making them at home for Edmund's big show. 10 feet away, in the corner of the room, Langdon stood transfixed, not by the massive television wall, but by a small object he had just spotted. It was displayed on an elegant pedestal, as if it were part of a museum exhibition. Before him, a single test tube was ensconced in a metal display case with a glass front. The test tube was corked and labeled, and contained a murky brownish liquid. For a moment, Langdon wondered if maybe it were some kind of medicine Edmund had been taking. Then he read the name on the label. "That's impossible," he told himself. "Why would this be here?" There were very few famous test tubes in the world, but Langdon knew this one certainly qualified. "I can't believe Edmund owns one of these. He had probably purchased this scientific artifact under the radar for an enormous price, just like he did with the Gauguin painting in Casa Milà." Langdon crouched down and peered at the 70-year-old glass vial. Its masking tape label was faded and worn, but the two names on the tube were still legible. Miller Urey. The hair on the back of Langdon's neck stood up as he read the names again. Miller Urey. My God, where do we come from? Chemists Stanley Miller and Harold Urey had conducted a legendary scientific experiment in the 1950s attempting to answer that very question. Their bold experiment had failed, but their efforts had been lauded worldwide and been known ever since as the Miller-Urey experiment. Langdon recalled being mesmerized in high school biology class to learn how these two scientists had attempted to recreate the conditions at the dawn of Earth's creation. A hot planet covered by a churning, lifeless ocean of boiling chemicals. The primordial soup. After duplicating the chemicals that existed in the early oceans and atmosphere, water, methane, ammonia, and hydrogen, Miller and Urey heated the concoction to simulate the boiling seas. Then they shocked it with electric charges to mimic lightning, and finally, they let the mixture cool, just as the planet's oceans had cooled. Their goal was simple and audacious: to spark life from a lifeless primal sea, to simulate creation, Langdon thought, using only science. Miller and Urey studied the mixture in hopes that primitive microorganisms might form in the chemical-rich concoction, an unprecedented process known as abiogenesis. Sadly, their attempts to create life from lifeless matter did not succeed. Rather than life, they were left with nothing but a collection of inert glass vials that now languished in a dark closet at the University of California in San Diego. To this day, creationists still cited the Miller-Urey experiment's failure as scientific proof that life could not have appeared on Earth without help from the hand of God. 30 seconds, Winston's voice boomed overhead. Langdon's thoughts spun as he stood up and stared into the darkened church around them. Just minutes ago, Winston had declared that science's greatest breakthroughs were those that created new models of the universe. He had also said that Mare Nostrum specialized in computer modeling, simulating complex systems and watching them run. The Miller-Urey experiment, Langdon thought, is an example of early modeling, simulating the complex chemical interactions occurring on primordial Earth.
Robert, Umbra called from across the room, it's starting.
On my way, he replied, moving toward the couch, suddenly overwhelmed by the suspicion that he might just have glimpsed a part of what Edmund had been working on. As he crossed the floor, Langdon recalled Edmund's dramatic preamble above the Guggenheim's grassy meadow. Tonight, let us be like the early explorers, he had said, those who left everything behind and set out across vast oceans. The age of religion is drawing to a close, and the age of science is dawning. Just imagine what would happen if we miraculously learned the answers to life's big questions. As Langdon took his seat beside Umbra, the massive wall display began broadcasting a final countdown. Umbra was studying him.
Are you okay, Robert?
Langdon nodded as a dramatic soundtrack filled the room and Edmund's face materialized on the wall before them, 5 feet tall. The celebrated futurist looked thin and tired, but he was smiling broadly into the camera. "Where do we come from?" he asked, the excitement in his voice rising as the music faded. "And where are we going?" Umbra took Langdon's hand and gripped it anxiously. "These two questions are part of the same story," Edmund declared. "So let's start at the beginning. The very beginning." With a playful nod, Edmund reached into his pocket and pulled out a small glass object. A vial of murky liquid bearing the faded names Miller and Urey. Langdon felt his heart race. "Our journey begins long ago, 4 billion years before Christ, adrift in the primordial soup." Chapter 91. Seated beside Umbra on the couch, Langdon studied Edmund's sallow face projected on the glass display wall and felt a pang of sorrow, knowing that Edmund had been suffering in silence from a deadly disease. Tonight, however, the futurist's eyes shone with pure joy and excitement. "In a moment, I'll tell you about this little vial," Edmund said, holding up the test tube. "But first, let's take a swim in the primordial soup." Edmund disappeared, and a lightning bolt flashed, illuminating a churning ocean where volcanic islands spewed lava and ash into a tempestuous atmosphere. "Is this where life commenced?" Edmund's voice asked. "A spontaneous reaction in a churning sea of chemicals? Or was it perhaps a microbe on a meteorite from space? Or was it God? Unfortunately, we can't go back in time to witness that moment. All we know is what happened after that moment, when life first appeared. Evolution happened, and we're accustomed to seeing it portrayed something like this." The screen now showed the familiar timeline of human evolution, a primitive ape slouching behind a line of increasingly erect hominids until the final one was fully erect, having shed the last of his body hair. "Yes, humans evolved," Edmund said. "This is an irrefutable scientific fact, and we've built a clear timeline based on the fossil record. But what if we could watch evolution in reverse?" Suddenly, Edmund's face started growing hair, morphing into a primitive human. His bone structure changed, becoming increasingly ape-like, and then the process accelerated to an almost blinding pace, showing glimpses of older and older species, lemurs, sloths, marsupials, platypuses, lungfish, plunging underwater and mutating through eels and fish, gelatinous creatures, plankton, amoebas, until all that was left of Edmund Kirsch was a microscopic bacterium, a single cell, pulsating in a vast ocean. "The earliest specks of life," Edmund said. "This is where our backward movie runs out of film. We have no idea how the earliest life forms materialized out of a lifeless chemical sea. We simply cannot see the first frame of this story." "T equals zero," Langdon mused, picturing a similar reverse movie about the expanding universe in which the cosmos contracted down to a single point of light, and cosmologists hit a similar dead end. "First cause," Edmund declared. "That's the term Darwin used to describe this elusive moment of creation. He proved that life continuously evolved, but he could not figure out how the process all started. In other words, Darwin's theory described the survival of the fittest, but not the arrival of the fittest." Langdon chuckled, having never heard it stated quite that way. "So, how did life arrive on Earth? In other words, where do we come from?" Edmund smiled. "In the next few minutes, you'll have an answer to that question. But trust me, as stunning as that answer is, it's only half of tonight's story."
He looked directly into the camera and gave an ominous grin. As it turns out, where we come from is utterly fascinating. But where we are going is utterly shocking. Umbra and Langdon exchanged a perplexed look, and although Langdon sensed this was more of Edmund's hyperbole, the statement left him feeling increasingly uneasy. Life's origin, Edmund continued, it has remained a profound mystery since the days of the first creation stories. For millennia, philosophers and scientists have been searching for some kind of record of this very first moment of life. Edmund now held up the familiar test tube containing the murky liquid. In the 1950s, two such seekers, chemists Miller and Urey, ran a bold experiment that they hoped might unveil exactly how life began. Langdon leaned over and whispered to Umbra, "That test tube is right over there." He pointed to the display pedestal in the corner. She looked surprised. "Why would Edmund have it?" Langdon shrugged. Judging from the strange collection of items in Edmund's apartment, this vial was probably just a piece of scientific history that he wanted to own. Edmund quickly described Miller and Urey's efforts to recreate the primordial soup, trying to create life within a flask of non-living chemicals. The screen now flashed a faded New York Times article from March 8, 1953, titled, "Looking Back 2 Billion Years." "Obviously," Edmund said, "this experiment raised some eyebrows. The implications could have been earth-shattering, especially for the religious world. If life magically appeared inside this test tube, we would know conclusively that the laws of chemistry alone are indeed enough to create life. We would no longer require a supernatural being to reach down from heaven and bestow upon us the spark of creation. We would understand that life simply happens, as an inevitable byproduct of the laws of nature. More importantly, we would have to conclude that because life spontaneously appeared here on Earth, it almost certainly did the same thing elsewhere in the cosmos, meaning man is not unique. Man is not at the center of God's universe, and man is not alone in the universe." Edmund exhaled. "However, as many of you may know, the Miller-Urey experiment failed. It produced a few amino acids, but nothing even closely resembling life. The chemists tried repeatedly, using different combinations of ingredients, different heat patterns, but nothing worked. It seemed that life, as the faithful had long believed, required divine intervention. Miller and Urey eventually abandoned their experiments. The religious community breathed a sigh of relief, and the scientific community went back to the drawing board." He paused, an amused glimmer in his eyes. "That is, until 2007, when there was an unexpected development." Edmund now told the tale of how the forgotten Miller-Urey testing vials had been rediscovered in a closet at the University of California in San Diego after Miller's death. Miller's students had reanalyzed the samples using far more sensitive contemporary techniques, including liquid chromatography and mass spectrometry. And the results had been startling. Apparently, the original Miller-Urey experiment had produced many more amino acids and complex compounds than Miller had been able to measure at the time. The new analysis of the vials even identified several important nucleobases, the building blocks of RNA and, perhaps eventually, DNA. "It was an astounding science story," Edmund concluded, "re-legitimizing the notion that perhaps life does simply happen without divine intervention." It seemed the Miller-Urey experiment had indeed been working, but just needed more time to gestate. "Let's remember one key point. Life evolved over billions of years, and these test tubes had been sitting in a closet for just over 50. If the timeline of this experiment were measured in miles, it was as if our perspective were limited to only the very first inch." He let that thought hang in the air. "Needless to say," Edmund went on,
there was a sudden resurgence in interest surrounding the idea of creating life in a lab. I remember that, Langdon thought. The Harvard biology faculty had thrown a department party they billed as BYOB, Build Your Own Bacterium. There was, of course, a strong reaction from modern religious leaders, Edmund said, placing air quotes around the word modern. The wall display refreshed to the homepage of a website, creation.com, which Langdon recognized as a recurring target of Edmund's wrath and ridicule. The organization was indeed strident in its creationist evangelizing, but it was hardly a fair example of the modern religious world. Their mission statement read, "To proclaim the truth and authority of the Bible and to affirm its reliability, in particular, its Genesis history." "This site," Edmund said, "is popular, influential, and it contains literally dozens of blogs about the dangers of revisiting Miller-Urey's work. Fortunately for the folks at creation.com, they have nothing to fear. Even if this experiment succeeds in producing life, it probably won't happen for another 2 billion years. Edmund again held up the test tube. "As you can imagine, I would like nothing more than to fast forward 2 billion years, re-examine this test tube, and prove all the creationists wrong. Unfortunately, accomplishing that would require a time machine." Edmund paused with a wry expression. "And so? I built one." Langdon glanced over at Ambra, who had barely moved since the presentation started. Her dark eyes were transfixed by the screen. "A time machine," Edmund said, "is not that difficult to build. Let me show you what I mean." A deserted barroom appeared, and Edmund walked into it, moving to a pool table. The balls were racked in their usual triangular pattern, waiting to be broken. Edmund took a pool cue, bent over the table, and firmly struck the cue ball. It raced toward the waiting rack of balls. An instant before it collided with the rack, Edmund shouted, "Stop!" The cue ball froze in place, magically pausing a moment before impact. "Right now," Edmund said, eyeing the frozen moment on the table, "if I asked you to predict which balls would fall into which pockets, could you do it?" "Of course not. There are literally thousands of possible breaks. But what if you had a time machine and could fast forward 15 seconds into the future, observe what happens with the pool balls, and then return?" "Believe it or not, my friends, we now have the technology to do that." Edmund motioned to a series of tiny cameras on the edges of the table. "Using optical sensors to measure the cue ball's velocity, rotation, direction, and spin axis as it moves, I can obtain a mathematical snapshot of the ball's motion at any given instant. With that snapshot, I can make extremely accurate predictions about its future motion." Langdon recalled using a golf simulator once that employed similar technology to predict with depressing accuracy his tendency to slice golf shots into the woods. Edmund now pulled out a large smartphone. On the screen was the image of the pool table with its virtual cue ball frozen in place. A series of mathematical equations hung over the cue ball. "Knowing the cue ball's exact mass, position, and velocity," Edmund said, "I can compute its interactions with the other balls and predict the outcome." He touched the screen, and the simulated cue ball sprang to life, smashing into the waiting rack of balls, scattering them, and sinking 4 balls in 4 different pockets. 4 balls, Edmund said, eyeing the phone. "Pretty good shot." He glanced up at the audience. "Don't believe me?" He snapped his fingers over the real pool table, and the cue ball released, streaking across the table, loudly smacking into the other balls, and sending them scattering. The same 4 balls fell in the same 4 pockets. "Not quite a time machine," Edmund said with a grin, "but it does enable us to see the future. In addition, it lets me modify the laws of physics. For example, I can remove friction so that the balls will never slow down, rolling forever until every last ball eventually falls into a pocket. He typed a few keys and launched the simulation again. This time after the break, the ricocheting balls never slowed down, bouncing wildly around the table, eventually falling into pockets at random, until there were only two balls left careening around the table. "And if I get tired of waiting for these last two balls to drop," Edmund said, "I can just fast-forward the process." He touched the screen, and the two remaining balls accelerated in a blur, streaking around the table until they finally fell into pockets. "This way I can see the future long before it happens. Computer simulations are really just virtual time machines." He paused. "Of course, this is all fairly simple math in a small, closed system like a pool table. But what about a more complex system?" Edmund held the Miller-Urey vial and smiled. "I'm guessing you can see where I'm going with this. Computer modeling is a kind of time machine, and it lets us see the future. Perhaps even billions of years into the future." Umbra shifted on the couch, her eyes never leaving Edmund's face. "As you can imagine," Edmund said, "I am not the first scientist to dream of modeling the Earth's primordial soup. In principle, it's an obvious experiment. But in practice, it's a nightmare of complexity." Turbulent primordial seas appeared again amid lightning, volcanoes, and massive waves. "Modeling the ocean's chemistry requires simulation at the molecular level. It would be like predicting the weather so accurately that we knew the precise location of every air molecule at any given moment. Any meaningful simulation of the primordial sea would therefore require a computer to understand not only the laws of physics, motion, thermodynamics, gravity, conservation of energy, and so forth, but chemistry as well, so it could accurately recreate the bonds that would form between every atom within a boiling ocean stew." The view above the ocean now plunged beneath the waves, magnifying down into a single drop of water, where a turbulent swirl of virtual atoms and molecules were bonding and breaking apart. "Sadly," Edmund said, reappearing on screen, "a simulation confronted by this many possible permutations requires a massive level of processing power, far beyond the capability of any computer on Earth." His eyes again twinkled with excitement. "That is, any computer except one." A pipe organ rang out, playing the famous opening trill to Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, along with a stunning wide-angle photograph of Edmund's massive two-story computer.
"E-wave,"
Umbra whispered, speaking for the first time in many minutes. Langdon stared at the screen. "Of course. It's brilliant." Accompanied by the dramatic organ soundtrack, Edmund launched into a fervent video tour of his supercomputer, finally unveiling his quantum cube. The pipe organ climaxed with a thunderous chord. Edmund was literally pulling out all the stops. "The bottom line," he concluded, "is that E-Wave is capable of recreating the Miller-Urey experiment in virtual reality, with startling accuracy. I cannot model the entire primordial ocean, of course, so I created the same 5-liter closed system that Miller and Urey used." A virtual flask of chemicals now appeared. The view of the liquid became magnified and remagnified until it reached the atomic level, showing atoms bouncing around in the heated mixture, bonding and rebonding, under the influences of temperature, electricity, and physical motion. "This model incorporates everything we have learned about the primordial soup since the days of the Miller-Urey experiment, including the probable presence of hydroxyl radicals from electrified steam and carbonyl sulfides from volcanic activity, as well as the impact of reducing atmosphere theories." The virtual liquid on screen continued to roil, and clusters of atoms began to form. "Now, let's fast forward the process," Edmund said excitedly, and the video surged ahead in a blur, showing the formation of increasingly complex compounds. "After 1 week, we start to see the same amino acids that Miller and Urey saw.
the image blurred again, moving faster now. And then, at about the 50-year mark, we start to see hints of the building blocks of RNA. The liquid kept churning faster and faster. "And so, I let it run," Edmund shouted, his voice rising in intensity. The molecules on screen continued to bond, the complexity of the structures increasing as the program fast-forwarded centuries, millennia, millions of years. As the images raced ahead with blinding speed, Edmund called out joyfully, "And guess what eventually appeared inside this flask?" Langdon and Ambra leaned forward with excitement. Edmund's exuberant expression suddenly deflated. "Absolutely nothing," he said. "No life, no spontaneous chemical reaction, no moment of creation, just a jumbled mix of lifeless chemicals." He let out a heavy sigh. "I could draw only one logical conclusion." He stared dolefully into the camera. "Creating life requires God." Langdon stared in shock. "What is he saying?" After a moment, a faint grin crept across Edmund's face. "Or," he said, "perhaps I had missed one key ingredient in the recipe." Chapter 92. Ambra Vidal sat mesmerized, imagining the millions of people around the globe who, right now, just like her, were fully engrossed in Edmund's presentation. "So, what ingredient was I missing?" Edmund asked. "Why did my primordial soup refuse to produce life?" "I had no idea. So I did what all successful scientists do. I asked somebody smarter than I am." A scholarly, bespectacled woman appeared. Dr. Constance Gerhard, biochemist, Stanford University. "How can we create life?" the scientist laughed, shaking her head. "We can't. That's the point. When it comes to the process of creation, crossing that threshold where inanimate chemicals form living things, all of our science goes out the window. There is no mechanism in chemistry to explain how that happens. In fact, the very notion of cells organizing themselves into life forms seems to be in direct conflict with the law of entropy." "Entropy," Edmund repeated, now appearing on a beautiful beach. "Entropy is just a fancy way of saying things fall apart. In scientific language, we say an organized system inevitably deteriorates." He snapped his fingers, and an intricate sandcastle appeared at his feet. "I've just organized millions of sand grains into a castle. Let's see how the universe feels about that." Seconds later, a wave came in and washed away the castle. "Yep, the universe located my organized grains of sand and disorganized them, spreading them over the beach. This is entropy at work. Waves never crash onto beaches and deposit sand in the shape of a sandcastle. Entropy dissolves structure. Sandcastles never spontaneously appear in the universe. They only disappear." Edmund snapped his fingers again and reappeared in an elegant kitchen. "When you heat coffee," he said, pulling a steaming cup from a microwave, "you focus heat energy into a mug. If you leave that mug on the counter for an hour, the heat dissipates into the room and spreads itself out evenly, like grains of sand on a beach. Entropy again. And the process is irreversible. No matter how long you wait, the universe will never magically reheat your coffee." Edmund smiled. "Nor will it unscramble a broken egg or rebuild an eroded sandcastle." Ambra recalled once seeing an art installation called Entropy, a line of old cement blocks, each more crumbled than the last, slowly disintegrating into a pile of rubble. Dr. Gerhard, the spectacled scientist, reappeared. "We live in an entropic universe," she said, "a world whose physical laws randomize, not organize. So the question is this: How can lifeless chemicals magically organize themselves into complex life forms? I've never been a religious person, but I have to admit the existence of life is the only scientific mystery that has ever persuaded me to consider the idea of a creator.
Edmund materialized, shaking his head. I find it unnerving when smart people use the word creator. He gave a good-natured shrug. They do it, I know, because science simply has no good explanation for the beginnings of life. But trust me, if you're looking for some kind of invisible force that creates order in a chaotic universe, there are far simpler answers than God. Edmund held out a paper plate on which splinters of iron filings had been scattered. He then produced a large magnet and held it beneath the plate. Instantly, the filings leaped into an organized arc, aligning perfectly with one another. An invisible force just organized these filings. Was it God? No. It was electromagnetism. Edmund now appeared beside a large trampoline. On its taut surface were scattered hundreds of marbles. A random mess of marbles, he stated. But if I do this, he hoisted a bowling ball onto the trampoline's rim and rolled it onto the elastic fabric, its weight created a deep indentation and immediately the scattered marbles raced into the depression, forming a circle around the bowling ball. The organizing hand of God? Edmund paused. No, again. It was just gravity. He now appeared in close-up. As it turns out, life is not the only example of the universe creating order. Non-living molecules organize themselves all the time into complex structures. A montage of images materialized. A tornado vortex, a snowflake, a rippled riverbed, a quartz crystal, the rings of Saturn. As you can see, sometimes the universe does organize matter, which seems to be the exact opposite of entropy, Edmund sighed. So, which is it? Does the universe prefer order or chaos? Edmund reappeared, now walking down a pathway toward the famed dome of Massachusetts Institute of Technology. According to most physicists, the answer is chaos. Entropy is indeed king, and the universe is constantly disintegrating toward disorder. Kind of a depressing message. Edmund paused and turned with a grin. But today I've come to meet the bright young physicist who believes there is a twist. A twist that may hold the key to how life began. Jeremy England? Langdon was startled to recognize the name of the physicist Edmund was now describing. The 30-something MIT professor was currently the toast of Boston academia, having caused a global stir in a new field called quantum biology. Coincidentally, Jeremy England and Robert Langdon shared the same prep school alma mater, Phillips Exeter Academy, and Langdon had first learned of the young physicist in the school's alumni magazine in an article titled Dissipation-Driven Adaptive Organization. Although Langdon had only skimmed the story and barely understood it, he recalled being intrigued to learn that his fellow Exe was both a brilliant physicist and also deeply religious, an Orthodox Jew. Langdon began to understand why Edmund had been so interested in England's work. On screen, another man appeared, identified as NYU physicist Alexander Grossberg. Our big hope, Grossberg said, is that Jeremy England has identified the underlying physical principle driving the origin and evolution of life. Langdon sat up a bit straighter upon hearing that, as did Umbra. Another face appeared. If England can demonstrate his theory to be true, said Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Edward J. Larson, his name would be remembered forever. He could be the next Darwin. My God. Langdon had known Jeremy England was making waves, but this sounded more like tsunamis. Carl Franck, a physicist from Cornell, added, Every 30 years or so we experience these gigantic steps forward, and this might be it. A series of headlines flashed across the screen in rapid succession. Meet the scientist who could disprove God. crushing creationism. Thanks, God, but we don't need your help anymore. The list of headlines continued, joined now by snippets from major scientific journals, all of which seemed to proclaim the same message. If Jeremy England could prove his new theory, the implications would be earth-shattering, not just for science, but for religion as well. Langdon eyed the final headline on the wall from the online magazine Salon, January 3, 2015. God is on the ropes. The brilliant new science that has creationists and the Christian right terrified. A young MIT professor is finishing Darwin's task and threatening to undo everything the wacky right holds dear. The screen refreshed, and Edmund reappeared, striding purposefully along the hallway of a university science facility. So what is this gigantic step forward that has so terrified creationists? Edmund beamed as he paused outside a door marked England, Lab at MIT Physics. Let's go inside and ask the man himself. Chapter 93. The young man who now appeared on Edmund's display wall was physicist Jeremy England. He was tall and very thin, with an unkempt beard and a quietly bemused smile. He stood before a blackboard filled with mathematical equations. First, England said, his tone friendly and unassuming, let me just say that this theory is not proven. It's just an idea. He gave a modest shrug. Although, I admit, if we can ever prove that it's true, the implications are far-reaching. For the next 3 minutes, the physicist outlined his new idea, which, like most paradigm-altering concepts, was unexpectedly simple. Jeremy England's theory, if Langdon understood it correctly, was that the universe functioned with a singular directive, one goal, to spread energy. In the simplest terms, when the universe found areas of focused energy, it spread that energy out. The classic example, as Kirsch had mentioned, was the cup of hot coffee on the counter. It always cooled, dispersing its heat to the other molecules in the room in accordance with the second law of thermodynamics. Langdon suddenly understood why Edmund had asked him about the world's creation myths, all of which contained imagery of energy and light spreading out infinitely and illuminating the darkness. England believed that there was a twist, however, which related to how the universe spread energy. We know the universe promotes entropy and disorder, England said, so we may be surprised to see so many examples of molecules organizing themselves. On the screen, several images that had appeared earlier now returned. A tornado vortex, a rippled riverbed, a snowflake. All of these, England said, are examples of dissipative structures. Collections of molecules that have arranged themselves in structures that help a system disperse its energy more efficiently. England quickly illustrated how tornadoes were nature's way of dispelling a concentrated area of high pressure by converting it into a rotational force that eventually exhausted itself. The same held true for rippled riverbeds, which intercepted the energy of